Okay, good morning, honorable members. Team PBO, Team FFC, members from the provinces who are in the platform, the colleagues and the media, all the stakeholders who are on the platform having an interest in what we're doing, you are welcomed. And I will request that for those who can, who do not experience load shedding or have a stable network, please open your videos as and when you speak, because we also want to make or cooperate with the communications from Parliament. All the streams are live, they have joined. We will appreciate, but if you don't have a stable network, there's nothing you can do. It's understandable, but please indicate. We will really appreciate if you can do that. And also, you are requested please to frame yourself correctly, because you wouldn't be happy. Sometimes we see the upper part of your head or from above your eyes. And I know you wouldn't be happy that the country see that part only, will want to see you in full. Thank you very much. Can you flag the agenda, Mr. Nodata? Today we are going to receive two presentations from FFC and Parliamentary Budget Office. The two presentations are on the second adjustment appropriation bill B4 of 2023. Both presentations. And I don't know if Treasury, I know usually they are part of us, Cindy and others. You are also welcomed. The FFC, they are going to present on division of, both of them. Division of Revenue is B2, 2023 and 2023, and second adjustment appropriations. B4 2023. So there are two bills that we are dealing with. My apologies on that. We have allocated the time as per our estimation, looking at the time and the hours that we have from Parliament for this session. And I will now request the Secretariat to deal with item number 2. You are most welcome and feel free to participate.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, Chairperson, honorable members and guests. Chairperson, we have, from the committee side, we have one apology, honorable members' apology. We also received one apology from provinces, since we invited provinces to be part of this meeting. Northern Cape Portfolio Committee, they are unable to join us. They have a session with IEC. We also received an apology from Commissioner Fowler from the FFC side, but it might be probably possible that the colleagues from FFC will also address that apology, but he sent an apology directly to ourselves. Thank you, Chair. Over to you.
Thank you. We also had have an apology from Honorable Karim. He will not be with us until the end of the meeting due to some pressures. He's needed urgently somewhere. He has to attend to that urgent matter, but he will be with us until then. Honorable members, let's note the presentations, because the deliberations will be done after the presentations. Can I request Team FFC? I don't know if the chairperson is on the platform. Is she the one who's going to lead? Over to you, Team FFC.
Thank you so much, Chairperson. Yes, indeed, I am leading the delegation from the Financial and Fiscal Commission. Thank you so much to yourself, Honorable Chairperson, and to Honorable Members, to just thank you for this opportunity, accompanied as well by commissioners who are on the platform. You have noted the apology from one of our commissioners. I'm also accompanied by our research team as well. And I would like to move on to the next slide. Thank you so much. So who is the Financial and Fiscal Commission, and why are we here today? The Financial and Fiscal Commission is established in terms of Section 220 of the Constitution of the Republic. The Constitution provides, amongst other things, that the Commission is an independent and impartial advisory institution to Parliament, provincial legislatures, organized local government, and other organs of state on the division of revenue amongst the three spheres of government and any other financial and fiscal matters. Our submission today on the 2023 Division of Revenue Bill, the 2022-23 Second Adjustment Appropriation Bill is made in terms of the Constitution of the Republic, the Intergovernmental Fiscal Relations Act, as well as the Money Bills Amendment Procedure and Related Matters Act as amended. The Financial and Fiscal Commission is mandated, Honorable Chairperson and members, to advise on all legislation pertaining to the equitable share and allocation of revenue, government guarantees, provincial taxes, municipal fiscal powers and functions, provincial loans and municipal loans, as well as any other financial and fiscal matters. Quite important to note that all these legislative prescripts can only be enacted after the Financial and Fiscal Commission has been consulted. Moving on to the next slide. Our presentation, therefore, today, Honorable Chairperson, will essentially focus on specific items on our presentation outline. On item number 4, we will give our analysis on the 2022-23 Second Adjustment Appropriation Bill. Thereafter, we will also give an analysis and our recommendations on the 2023 Division of Revenue Bill at both provincial and local government. Also give our recommendations on the public sector institutions and investments. And finally, I will come in towards the end with very clear and coherent remarks and recommendations on the Commission's stance on these matters. Without wasting time, I'd like to hand over to our Head of Research, who will take us through the presentation. Chen?
Thank you very much, Chair, and good morning, Honourable Chair and members and colleagues on the platform. Honourable Chair and members, our presentation, importantly, and I think it's only fitting that we look at also the 2022-23 Second Adjustment Appropriation as it serves, as contextualizes very importantly the precursor to what is to come and how some of the decisions made in terms of the 2023 main appropriation and also the and all the other divisional revenue business. Importantly, in the second adjustment appropriation bill, Total adjustment amounts to 9.5 billion. There were pluses and minuses deductions on the adjustments. And we've listed here, first thing, 4.5 billion addition for carry through costs associated with the public sector wage increase. We note the recent activities, especially in terms of labor relations across the public sector. Apparently, and as always, these things are close to the hearts and also livelihoods of the people, and hence the agreements or the processes thereof to finally arrive and find each other from the both employer-employee side on how much is the cost escalation of the public wage is reached. 8.4 billion for bailouts across various, I think, three or four state-owned entities, and we'll go into the details there. But the broad, or shall we say, the highlights of it is that it's concerning that we are still in 2022-23 dealing with many of these persistent issues, financial issues of public entities. 300 million for political parties funds. And lastly, most problematic, I'd say, and is the 3.783 billion with a B of unspent SRD grants, unimplemented, I should rather emphasize, within the social development votes. This is, and which makes this second adjustment appropriation so important as a precursor, is that you recall, Honorable Chair Members, that back in MPPBS time, there was already a 1.8 billion that was already projected to underspend, and that has persisted and escalated to now, as we see here, 3.7 billion. In terms of our divisional revenue bills or bill, and but provinces and local governments in budget 2023, is that there are reductions and shifting of conditional grants between direct and indirect, especially in within the health sector as well as the disaster grants. And also the amendments to Section 7 of the Divisional Revenue Bill. This is about the pledging of the provincial grants money forward to the to present costing the infrastructure commitments. The issue there is that the broad concept is correct, but implementation is another issue, and that clearly has to do with the credibility and as well as what are those and the project management of those infrastructure developments. And lastly, the increase in the LGES funding is looking at positive in terms of additions for local government equitable share. However, it's mostly to do with or as a response to, of course, the over escalation of electricity and tariffs for basic services. So with that, Chairs, my intro, let me hand over to Sasha Peters, who will take over and the rest of the team to take you through the presentation proper. Thank you, Chair.
Good morning, Chair, members of the committee and other colleagues. Chair, these next two slides speak to the second adjustment appropriation bill. As Chen mentioned, the bill proposes adjustments totaling 9.5 billion. And this slide outlines some of the aspects that the Commission wishes to raise in relation to the bill. So the first relates to that 4.5 billion in carry-through costs associated with the public service wage increase of 2022-23. This amount is spread across the various national votes, and the votes receiving the largest share of these carry-through costs are the labor-intensive votes within the safety and security cluster, namely the police, defense, correctional services, and justice and constitutional development votes. In total, these four votes make up around 77% of that total carry-through cost of 4.5 billion. Generally, on this issue of the public sector wage bill, the Commission notes that the impact of wage bill settlements continues to remain one of the key cost drivers and risks to the fiscus. Chen alluded to the ongoing developments around wage bill, and we also note that work is being done by the by DPSA and National Treasury, as well as other stakeholders, to devise a single remuneration framework for the public sector. And we look forward to the details around this work and how it can assist in better managing the public sector wage bill. The bulk of the adjustments in the second adjustment appropriation bill is in relation to the SOE bailouts. It totals 8.4 billion. Of that 8.4 billion, 5 billion is for the land bank, 2.4 billion for the post office, and 1 billion for SAA. And Chair, here the FFC maintains its fundamental stance that bailouts to poorly performing SOEs are fiscally unsound, and also that when allocating these funds to poorly performing entities, the bailouts give rise to the creation of perverse incentives. And the SOEs that are being bailed out in this round are not first-time bailouts. We know that with respect to the post office, bailouts amounting to 7 billion was allocated between 2016 and 2019, but the entity has remained financially weak. With the land bank, the AG has cautioned that whereas the bank has been able to attain an unqualified audit for 2021-22, it remains at risk due to its debt default situation. Likewise with SAA, who we see, according to the budget review, has yet to submit its most recent financial statements. So these are SOEs who we know performance has been weak, and we need those stringent conditions to prevent the perverse incentives. And it's also important to note that whereas we've had the implementation of preconditions and conditions for bailouts, including financial and operational reporting, while these things have been implemented, the outcomes related to these measures have been quite limited. The second adjustment appropriation bill also contains 300 million under the Home Affairs vote for the Represented Political Parties Fund. And as members will know, funding through this fund is for political parties participating in Parliament and provincial legislatures. And given that our next general election is in 2024 and funding from this fund can be used for election-related activities, an increase in this in the year prior to the election is not unexpected. And we note that the funding has more than tripled between 2021-22 and 2022. Finally, the issue we'd like to raise within the second adjustment appropriation bill relates to the underspending of 3.8 billion with respect to the SRD grant. As Chen mentioned, we had the 1.8 billion worth of underspending that was tabled in the first adjustment appropriation bill. This time it's 3.8 billion. And we, the 2023 budget review notes that the underspending is due to improved means testing. And the Commission would like to record its concern around the tightening of the eligibility criteria of this grant that is happening alongside worsening socioeconomic conditions and cost of living crisis that disproportionately affects our poorer households. So in relation to the bill, Chair, we have a few recommendations. If you can move to the next slide, please. Thank you. So Chair, as mentioned earlier, the Commission reiterates its stance on SOE bailouts and that they can prompt moral hazard behavior. especially when we are continuously bailing out poorly performing SOEs. And as such, we again recommend that government must devise a strong system of accountability and measures of control to mitigate this kind of behavior and the risks that come with it. The other important recommendation in this section relates to the unspent SRD grant funds. And the Commission raises concern around the progressive erosion in the number of people that are able to access the SRD grant as a result of the continuous tightening of the eligibility criteria. And this point really underlines the need for government to find a permanent and sustainable alternative for the SRD grant. If I can hand over to Sabelo. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Asha, and good morning to the chairperson, and good morning to honorable members and all other colleagues in the platform. Okay, yes, I'll take you through to the following few slides on the provincial government allocation with respect to what has been allocated to them and how much, whether there has been growth or there has been some reductions. What we've noted here is that, firstly, over the MTF 2023, that the budget proposes a total allocation of 2.2 trillion. And that has increased from 2 trillion in the 2022 MTF. And then nominally, this represents about 9.5% growth. And the total allocation for provinces in 2022 budget for 2022-23 was around 658.4 billion. And this has been revised upwards in the current financial year to 684.5 billion. And then, yes, if you look at it, what has happened here is that there's been an increase with respect to the allocation for provinces, and those are mainly driven by adjustments as other colleagues have indicated, for the compensation of employees mainly, and again as a response to the natural disasters and human resource and training. For 2023-24, then the 2020-22 MTPTS, as we look at what was indicated during the 2022 MTPTS for 2023-24, then the projected allocation was around 684.4 billion for provinces. And then what is happening here is that is a breakdown, 556.4 billion equitable share and 128 billion for conditional grant. And then in total, what we've seen for 2023 budget is that the provincial allocation has been revised upwards to 694 billion. That is, if you look at the overall addition, then you'll see that it's an additional allocation of about 9.6 billion. And I can just emphasize here that the adjustments are mainly on the provincial equitable share for public servants, wage bill, or constitution of employees, as indicated by other colleagues. And then we also have a total of 1.1 billion that has been added for that over the 2023 MTF. And then now, in overall, what we're emphasizing here is that while we see these adjustments that have been made and implemented, if you look at the 2022 and 2023 MTF adjustments, are marginal. You can go to the next slide. Adjust marginal as shown here, you'll see that from on 2022 MTBTS, then the budget jumps over 2 trillion over the MTF, and then 2023 budget is also over 2.2 trillion. And then while we acknowledge that there has been those increases, as you can see, the jump there over that 2 trillion. But if you look deeply on what is happening, is that that jump only accommodates for compensation for employees and as a response of funding that are needed for restoration of damaged infrastructure by natural disasters. So in essence, there hasn't been any adjustments for provinces to respond to increasing needs and also to factor things like inflation. Then now, this slide highlights some of the key conditional grants, what has been happening there. We've taken some few of those main conditional grants and did some deeper analysis. So what we've seen here is that the total provincial conditional grant allocation for this financial year amounts to 127.5 billion and is increasing from 123.7 billion compared to the last financial year. And this is just a marginal nominal increase of about 3.1%. Then key to note here is that we've taken a deeper analysis on the HSDG housing, human settlements, development grant, which is for housing. Then what we've seen there is that if you look recently in these outer years, you see an increase in the allocation. For example, increasing from 13.4 billion in 2021-22 and will reach about 14.9 billion in 2023-24, that is the current year. But key to note here is that while you see that increase, particularly in the outer year, it's key to note that increase is still far lower or below what was allocated in the year 2020-21. Because in 2020-21, allocation for HSDG amounted to 19.6 billion. So you can see that there hasn't been any, the allocation didn't even catch up with that allocation for that year. And then we're noting that with concern that this could affect again the mission to improve the housing conditions of households in the country, particularly given the higher rate of unemployment, given the economic conditions of the country. And then we're saying this will delay the reduction of housing backlog. And then again, what we are noting here in 2023 budget is the shifting of the provincial emergency housing from provinces to the national from this year going forward. And this we take it as a form of recentralization, and we commission is concerned with this development and movement because it's of the view that the lower spheres of government are better positioned to understand and implement programs and projects than the national department. And the other thing that we're noting here is that the district health program, there's been about 7.6% decrease, it has been reduced or revised downwards. And then now we're noting with concern that reduction, particularly given that if you look deeper, you'll see that the scope has been increased or has been expanded for this district health program. Then I would believe that would have a negative impact on the actual service delivered. Next slide. So in summary, flowing from that analysis, then we have three key recommendations for this section. Firstly, is that as we've noted that there's been a decrease of about 7.6% on the or on the health grant, this is health grant, then we are of the view that such a decrease will have a negative impact with respect to the delivery of services meant to be delivered through that grant. And then we are recommending that the Department of Health should indicate how this reduction is likely to affect service delivery in the sector and how this tighter budget will be managed, especially given the expanded scope of the district health program. Then secondly, we've noted in our presentation that there's been a shifting of emergency housing grant from provinces to the national. And then we reiterate, because as a commission we believe that provinces and municipalities are better positioned to respond to this. And that is the last recommendation. And then we're saying the commission recommends that the shift of commercial grants from lower spheres of government, from provinces or from local spheres of government, should be the last resort, as commission believes that it is a better position to understand and respond. And lastly, we've seen that there's been a shifting of emergency housing grant, which is meant for municipalities and provinces to provide things like the emergency housing to make sure that those households that are being affected by natural disasters are housed temporarily. But now we're saying here, it is key that while we, as a commission, we do support the funding of those emergency housing needs, but there's a need for these municipalities and provinces to develop and implement a long-term adaptation and mitigation strategy to address natural disasters. And then some of these things are just as easy as making sure that there are adequate and relevant pipes, drainage pipes that will take water from towns to the rivers, not allowing that water to come back again. So there are such small things that could be done to address some of these issues. With that, Chairperson, let me hand over to Kutso to present the local government staff. Thank you.
Thanks, Sabelo. Good morning, Chair, honorable members of the committee and colleagues. So I'll be taking you through the local government section of this presentation. Chair, we have seen in recent times how local government is faced with numerous challenges that deter the sector from delivering on its constitutional mandate of delivering services to the people. And one of these challenges is the political environment in which municipalities find themselves in, which has emanated from the 2021 local government elections, where we saw 66 out of 213 of the contested municipalities having had hung councils. And this have resulted in many parties forming coalition councils. And we know that even though that there are advantages to these alliances, it is also fraught with many disadvantages and has resulted in many service delivery disruptions. So we know, Chair, that to assist municipalities with their developmental role and to improve service delivery, municipalities need to strengthen municipal finances and investments with support from both national and the provincial spheres of government, as this will aid in cohesive planning between the three spheres of government to achieve the country's goals and resulting in broader economic activity and reversing current unemployment trends by promoting social and economic development activities. Given the insufficient capacity and the insurmountable challenges engulfing local government, the Commission notes the ongoing work being completed in reviewing the conditional grant system, and we support the government endeavors in supporting municipalities. Next slide, please. So over the 2023 MTEF, the local government sphere is set to receive total transfers amounting to 512.7 billion in indirect transfers and 26.6 billion in indirect local government conditional grant transfers. And the allocation through the local government equitable share will be 301.4 billion and conditional grants will be 163.5 billion. And the figure on this slide illustrates the various allocations to local government. The vertical division of revenue share of local government allocations is expected to increase over the MTEF from 9.7% in 2023-24 to a double digit of 10.1% in 2024-25 and 2025-26. The Commission notes and welcomes the additional allocation to local government as it will assist in alleviating some of the pressures municipalities face. And we also would like to reiterate that national and provincial spheres of government have a role in supporting municipalities in fulfilling their constitutional mandate. Next slide, please. Thank you. So the figure on this slide shows that the increases in the local government equitable share is the main driver behind the positive real growth of 3%. And the Commission welcomes the government's efforts to keep local government equitable share growth rate above inflation through increased allocation, as this will go a long way in offsetting the ever-increasing cost of basic services. However, we also know that the marginal increase puts added pressure on municipalities' ability to deliver services given the economic backdrop. Thank you. Next slide. And the figure on this slide, Chair, shows a steady decline in real growth rates of the infrastructure grant in 2023-2024 with zero growth in the outer years of the MTEF. And regarding the RSC labor replacement grant, we see that since 2019-20, the annual growth rate has been a 3-to-1 ratio between C2 and C1 municipalities. And in the Commission's 2023-24 Division of Revenue submission, we highlighted that this approach is skewed and in certain instances underallocates funds to district municipalities without any objective criteria. The objective, the Commission notes that National Treasury will equalize the growth rates for this allocation to C1 and C2 municipalities, and that this will be an interim solution until the review of Section 84 of the Municipal Structures Act is finalized. And the Commission also notes the current conditional grant review, and we recommend that as part of the review, the proliferation of infrastructure grants be reviewed and addressed, taking into account consideration of the previous recommendations by the FSC. Next slide, please. Thank you. The Commission notes the changes made to the baseline of three of the grants to the local government sphere, being the Urban Settlement Development Grant, the Public Transport Network Grant, and the Regional Bulk Infrastructure Grant. However, we also know that during the 2023 MTEF, municipal conditional grant baselines are expected to be reduced by over 735 million, with 574 million coming from direct conditional grants. We know that this reduction to the baseline grant is due to the discontinuation of the municipal emergency housing grant, with the funding to be shifted to the National Department of Human Settlements. And the Commission notes the steady decline in real growth rates of the municipal conditional grants in 2023-2024, with no growth in the outer years of the MTEF. And we advise that this will negatively impact on the outcomes of the economic recovery plan, which is based on infrastructure-led growth programs. The Commission also notes the changes made to the municipal infrastructure grant and the establishment of an indirect component and the basis of identifying municipalities needing support. Next slide, please. In terms of recommendations, the Commission notes the proposed increase in the total allocation to the local government's equitable share over the medium term However, we would like to reemphasize the previous recommendation of fundamentally reviewing the local government transfers, especially from the perspective of the vertical division of revenue. We believe that this review should also include a proper re-examination of the assumptions used in the white paper on local government. Secondly, the Commission recommends that the review of capacity building and infrastructure grants should consider that capacity building efforts are comprehensively consulted with and agreed to with a municipality. It should link capacity building actions to a municipality specific diagnosis of capacity challenges or deficits. And lastly, it should consider the consolidation of local government conditional grants into an integrated financial flow. Our last recommendation from this section, we would like to stress the need to determine the roles and functions of the role players in the district development model and the funding requirements or responsibilities so as to eliminate any ambiguities in the or in carrying out the model. Thanks, Chair. I will hand over to Chen to take us through the last section of our presentation. Thank you.
Thank you. Honourable Chair members, this last section before recommendations and concluding remarks by our chairperson is to look at remembering the public sector institutions and investments. As you can see, there are these in the second adjustment appropriation still in 2022-23 and for the going forward, it still appears that we will be entrenched with these SOEs who are facing or have been facing and will still face considerable hurdles and financial weak performances and really failing their developmental mandates. Well, to be fair, these SOEs, public entities, are important in the sense, especially an important feature for any developmental state or any state essentially that are especially taking on some of the public goods and services that needs support from the public sector. The issue is that this sector or this particular entity, if not monitored and controlled properly, as remember, one honorable member actually mentioned that what we need is actually competent CEOs and competent accounting officers managing these SOEs. If not, they will become the hemorrhage of the public sector and therefore the economy as a whole for the nation. So at the moment, this is to show as an example, SAA, and of course, there is history that even before 2020, that the entity is in battle, is facing issues. But this is to show that also how long it has been that these SOEs have been given the opportunities, ample opportunities and financial resources to turn the ship around, and they have failed to do so. And another thing to note here, Honourable Chair members, about public infrastructure investments, we note this as Commission and always emphasizing the importance of infrastructure development as an important mandate in the developmental state. And it's South Africa achieving its goals and national development plan even. However, and hence we see this shift in the recent years, this focus and injections into state-owned companies and public entities and so forth. However, that we are now today facing an issue of the failures in the basic services and particular sections of the basic services, not sometimes, as some may say, reticulation, which is the local governments, and sometimes the for instance, hospitals and schools, it would be provincial. So the points that we're trying to drive here is that although in general terms, public sector or public infrastructure investment is a driver, positive driver for development and growth indeed. However, different channels, different sectors and different spheres of governments
are means very different things in terms of public infrastructure investments. For instance, just to rerun this this concept again, is that national governments, they mostly dealing with office buildings because they are drivers of policies. And also it depends on which ones are client facing, if you like, citizen facing departments. But if they are to take on infrastructure development, it may be just office buildings. Provincial, it's health, it's education, so it's hospitals and schools, buildings. Local governments is reticulation of basic services of electricity, power, and water, and refuse sanitation. And so in that sense, there are, but only an aspect of those basic services. Generation, in terms of the constitution, they are not per se in the mandate of it, of generating electricity. It's very clearly stated that under the schedule that they are responsible for, local government, I mean, are responsible for reticulation, not generation. Public entities, as I said, and state-owned companies, important drivers for development, but it's also, they are sectoral. Some are doing, say, SAA is airline, SANRAL is about roads, Transnet is about rail and other important logistics, and of course, Eskom for electricity. So very different and very diverse a channel and or a driver for infrastructure development. It's not, say, we want to invest in infrastructure and that will somehow solve the problem. Different channels, different entities have different functions and effectiveness in terms of infrastructure development. Thank you very much, Chair. With that, let me hand over to my chairperson for the concluding remarks and recommendations. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you so much, Chen. To conclude, honorable members, with respect to the 2022 Second Adjustment Appropriation Bill, specifically on the bailouts to the three state-owned entities, the Commission's stance remains unchanged in that it fundamentally views bailouts as fiscally unsound. And as recommended in our previous submission, the government must devise systems of accountability and measures of control to mitigate state-owned entities from indulging in moral hazard behavior. Next slide. With respect to the 2023 Division of Revenue Bill at provincial level, the Commission notes with concern the 7.6% decrease in the district health program and recommends that the Department of Health elaborate on how it would likely affect service delivery and management, given the expanded scope of the district health program. While the Commission supports funding for emergency housing needs due to flooding, it reiterates its previous recommendation that the provinces and municipalities should develop and implement adaptation and mitigation strategies to address natural disasters in the long run. The Commission notes with concern the shifting of provincial and municipal emergency housing grants to the National Department of Human Settlements. The Commission recommends that shifting conditional grants from provincial and local government spheres to the national sphere should be the last resort, as lower spheres of government are better positioned to understand delivery needs. Last slide. With respect to the local government equitable share, the Commission recommends that the review of capacity building and infrastructure grants consider that capacity building efforts are comprehensively consulted with and agreed with a municipality. It should link capacity building actions to municipality specific diagnosis of capacity challenges or deficits. The Commission further notes the proposed increase in the total allocation to the local government equitable share over the medium term. However, the Commission would like to reemphasize the previous recommendations of fundamentally reviewing the local government transfers, especially given that
You are muted, Nombeko.
Okay.
I'm sorry, Chair, you were disturbed by me. Unaware that I'm unmuted. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And then the Financial and Fiscal Commission, finally, honorable members, would like to stress the need to determine the roles and functions of the role players in the district development model and the funding requirements and responsibilities to eliminate any ambiguity. On that last slide, I'd like to hand over to you, Chairperson. That is the end of our presentation. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Team FFC. 11 o'clock, I'll be experiencing load sharing from my side. So I'm just trying to nest the network. Hopefully, I'll not be cut off. And thanks so much for your presentation. Can I hand over to Team PBO, led by Dr. Janges? Over to you, Dr.
Thank you so much. Good morning, Chairperson, and good morning to honourable members from also the provincial members as well. Good morning to colleagues. Thank you so much for the opportunity for us to present. I'm with the team on the platform. Really, really appreciate this opportunity. We will start our presentation. I think I'll just quickly move off to the introduction slides. I think the main issue is really to give a brief about the division of revenue, but also comment on the second adjustment. I think importantly is that we do want to start by really giving a context on which the proposals are made, particularly looking at socio-economic context, because those are some of the context that gives direction to the allocation of proposals that are put out. We'll also give some of the analysis on some of the work we've been doing around slow spending or underspending in some of the functions of government, which is really a concern to us, given the needs that we'll outline at the beginning of our presentation. I think we'll also really comment on some of the infrastructure facilities that I put out, and we'll conclude. I think I'll give the team take us through and I'll come in at the end of the presentation. Thanks so much. We'll see Jonas start right away with the situation analysis. Thanks.
Good morning, Honourable Chair and colleagues. I'll be taking us today through the situational analysis, which is really talking about what context are we speaking from when we talk about the allocations that we see. So at the national sphere, we know that government is responsible for social protection. We know that many people in South Africa, a large proportion of South Africans, are subject to debilitating poverty and unemployment. And of course, institutional support is very important. As the president has noted, African women are the face of poverty. So it is very important that when we look at these budget allocations and divisions, that we consider how they respond to the needs of the most vulnerable in our society. We know that vulnerability to hunger or limited access to food has increased between 2019 and 2021. Of course, this takes into account the COVID-19 shocks, as well as the protracted cost of living crisis that South Africans have been facing for a very long time. The graph on the right shows the average household food basket, which is the dark green bar on the left, but it also shows what the other grant values are. So when we look at these grant values, none of them reach that household food basket, and even at the national minimum wage. So if you have one working person in the household or four, that wage would not be sufficient to meet the basic household food basket that is required to really keep that house afloat and well nourished. In terms of crime, which is also a national function, there's been an increase in the crime reported, which is very worrying, of course, in South Africa. So an average year-on-year crime increased by 9.55% between the 2021 December and 2022 December. We also know that gender-based violence and femicide are also a key concern. There's been worrying numbers between the quarter three and quarter four, there was an increase of 22% in the number of rapes that were reported. South Africa is on average one police officer for every 408 people, which is actually higher than what the United Nations recommendation is. However, this has to be read in the context of high crime in our society, which is driven by a number of socioeconomic factors and so forth. We note here that the budget is silent on the funding to implement the National Strategic Plan on the Gender-Based Violence and Femicide, and also that the budget allocates $7.8 billion to make provision for 5,000 police trainees over the next 3 years. Here we talk about at the provincial sphere, education. We know that socioeconomic indicators are still a great determinant of whether children are able to access education. There's been a decline of number of children aged 0 to 4 who attend grade R in preschool. As we know, there's been a policy change which requires grade R before school. We also know that grade R is significant because it helps children to learn how to read before or start learning to read by the time they get to school. However, new data from Oxford University shows that fewer than 50% of grade one children learn the letters of the alphabet by the end of grade one, which is, of course, worrying numbers. We've all seen the statistic that 78% of students cannot read for meaning in grade four. This was in 2016. However, it is estimated that this number will increase to 82%. And also there you see on the graph on the right that, of course, children from poorer households are more likely to stay at home with a parent or guardian. And so the lack of access to ECD disproportionately impacts poor households, particularly women who carry the burden of childcare. In terms of children 18 to 24 who are still attending secondary school, it is higher, obviously, for people with higher income groups. We also note here that 22.5% of females and 15.5% of males between the ages of 17 and 18, are not attending an educational institution because they do not have money for fees. So, of course, this ratio is higher for female students, which is concerning. And also thinking about the protracted cost of living crisis, how might these numbers increase? So how does this budget respond to some of these emerging pressures? And of course, education is important, or an important determinant for employment. We know that 40.1% of unemployed individuals had education levels below matric, whereas 34.4% had a matric. At the health level, the FFC has already covered some of the issues about the district health program. However, here we note here that we've seen an increase in infant mortality rate, under five mortality rate, and of course the our public healthcare system remains overstretched and underfunded. We'll be showing real per capita terms how this is changing. We know that we are not meeting the ideal ratio of one nurse to 16 people. We are currently at one nurse to 218 patients. And of course, the minister in 22 noted that there were close to 11,000 vacancies in state hospitals. And of course, with the discussions around the compensation of employees, we know that they will not be able to hire these people because the budget just isn't sufficient. But not only that, we're also regressing in terms of the primary health, in terms of primary health care. And so the numbers of ideal clinics is actually declining. At the local government, we know that local governments are struggling really to provide the basic services that they need. This is because they've got inadequate levels of funding, and so they are unable to provide adequate levels of quality-free basic services. There's been a lot of protests, as we know, and according to the Municipal IQ service delivery protests are back to pre-COVID-19 levels, with 193 protests recorded nationwide in 2022. Municipal IQ estimates that these will increase because of heightened frustration caused by load sharing. But not only that, I just want to highlight here, without going through all these due to time, but to say that protests are really costly. And if we think about, the policing costs that come with having to manage protests, the infrastructure that might need to be dealt with as a result of protests. So in a way, the way to prevent protests is really to provide the vital basic services that households need for cooking, cleaning, and so forth. In terms of provisioning of free basic services, there's been a decline in the number of people who are receiving these basic services, which is concerning because we all know that we are currently in a cost of living crisis. So obviously more households are unable to afford these basic goods. We see here that water, electricity, sewage and sanitation and solid waste have seen a decline in the number of people who are able to receive these services for free. And the reason for this is because millions of households that are eligible for free services do not get them due to the dysfunctional system for registration of indigent households. And so households are having to choose between feeding their children and paying for municipal services. Of course, this goes back to the white paper on local government and how the assumptions that were made about how local government would be able to generate its own revenue. Here we've got more numbers here showing the households that are funded for free basic services. This is on a National Treasury side, whereas on the next column, households that are actually receiving basic services. So you see that there's a large gap between what has been provisioned for versus what people are actually receiving. But also here we note that there's been significant price increases between 2010 and 2020 in rates and taxes, 118% in electricity tariffs, 177%, and water tariffs, 213%. And of course, between this time, our salaries and society salaries generally have not increased this significantly. But not only that, majority of households who are not in the waged economy are obviously unable to really afford these goods. They do not have access to wages, which are also increasing to deal with these pressures. Here, the point of the slide is really to show that the NDP has plans to or aims to eliminate poverty and reduce inequality primarily through the provisioning of basic public goods. And in the budget, it's noted that, we are following a fiscal consolidation framework and that the social wage is protected. However, we note, and I'll show in the next slides, that the social wage is declining in real terms. So it might be 51% in terms of the proportion, but in terms of the real terms, how it adjusts to population growth and inflation, it is not actually protected as is reported. But also to note here that the problem is not incrementalism in the budget is claimed by National Treasury, that budget provisions over many years have been insufficient for local government, and I'll extend this to all spheres, to operate properly. So we've got bigger problems on our plates. I will skip the slide because I've already mentioned most of these things, but here we highlight that, much of the services in terms of non-payment is not because people do not want to pay for basic goods and services, but it's because people really are living in poverty and many cannot afford these. And even when people do have electricity, 90% of South Africa has electrification. Even if they have access to that, they cannot afford to buy electricity. They cannot afford to buy the appliances that you need electricity for. And so you've got large proportions of our society using wood, for example, paraffin and other things to cook, even though our electrification levels seem high. Budget trends in terms of real terms. So here we see the real per capita spending by function group. We note here that there's a significant decline. So in 2025-26, we'll be spending less per person than we did in 2016-2017. There's been a slight improvement from the MTBPS in terms of what was projected for 2025-26, but it is still worrying that we'll be investing less per South African in the next couple of years. In terms of expenditure and health, this is also another concern. And of course, reductions in health in real terms are more pronounced given that medical inflation tends to be higher than consumer price inflation. So we've got here the numbers, but it's probably more than what you see here. The declines are actually more than what we've shown here. Again, we'll be spending less to South African in 2025-26 than we did. Than we did in 2016-2017. In terms of basic education, so this is only showing basic education. Again, it's the same trend, but here what we wanted to note is that National Treasury in the budget 2021 acknowledged that budget reductions would disproportionately impact no-fee-paying schools And so the impact of this budget must be queried because National Treasury has in the past admitted or acknowledged that there'd be significant impacts for North paying schools. And of course, these are the most vulnerable students in our society. And as I mentioned earlier, we're concerned about dropout rates. We're concerned about, you know, school attainment, particularly for children from low-income households. In terms of social grants, you know, they've increased a bit, but then they've declined. So there's been increases and declines over time, over the period. But with the child support grant, you kind of see how it goes flat there. But also worried about the foster care grant. We note here that most of the grants fall above the upper bound poverty line. However, the grants that have to do with children, which are the most vulnerable in our society, actually do not meet that. According to the PMBEJD, the child support grant of 480 Rand is 28% below the food poverty line and 43% below the average cost to feed a child a basic nutritious diet. And that is, of course, concerning because, of course, as we said, the malnutrition burden in South Africa is increasing and concerning. But not only that, I think it must be asked to Treasury why they project that the number of beneficiaries for the foster care grant will decline significantly by 7.5%. And this has to be queried. And then lastly here, we show that the COVID-19 SRD in terms has, in real terms, has significantly declined in terms of value over time. The FFC already noted the underspending concerns. We also note here that significant amounts of the money were shifted from DSD in the MTBPS. So significant amounts of money are being shifted. A lot of people are being excluded. DSD had projected that 10.9 million people would be the target group. However, they have not approved more than 7.8 million recipients in each month, which is concerning because of this criteria, which FFC has already highlighted. Not only that, the approval rates have been low, but also payments have been delayed, which is a continuous concern. I'll now hand over to my next colleague.
Thank you very much, Pusi. Good morning, honorable members and colleagues. I'm going to take you through the Division of Revenue Bill. Next slide, please. Okay, the objectives of the Division of Revenue Bill is to provide for the equitable division of nationally raised revenue between the national, provincial, and local spheres of government, with the provincial share being made of the equitable share and the conditional grants, and the local government being made of the equitable share, conditional grants, and the general fuel levy sharing with metros. Next slide. So in terms of the 2023 MTEF, it shows the objective to reprioritize the expenditure from the national and provincial spheres to local government. However, the long-term trend of the division of revenue across the three spheres of government shows that this objective has not been realized in the past. This is important to note, given that the local government has not been able to collect revenue as envisioned in the white paper on local government. Next slide. So this graph includes the debt service cost. In terms of rising debt costs as a share of expenditure have more than doubled since the global financial crisis, consuming expenditure that should be going towards the service delivery in the various spheres of government. Next slide. So when we take into account, when we account for inflation and the population growth, the allocation across the three spheres of government declines over the MTEF, reflecting government's continued fiscal consolidation stance, which caps growth in the expenditure over the MTEF. Next slide. So the table here shows the amount to be appropriated from the revenue fund for a selection of national departments. The last column shows the increases and decreases since the 2022 appropriations. The green column shows the percentage that the national departments transfer to other spheres of government or institutions that deliver services on their behalf. Next slide. So distributing the conditional grants transferred from the national departments to the provinces. So it shows which conditional grants are transferred to the provinces in the first, in the top table or first part of the table. And the second part of the table, it shows the grants that are transferred to municipalities, showing the audited outcomes and the MTS expenditure estimates for those grants to the provinces and to the municipalities. Next slide. This graph, the table shows the equitable provincial share. The total average annual MTF increase is 2.5%. The largest average annual increase is in Limpopo, which is 3.1%. And the estimated total of increases are between 10,063 million and 11,371 million, mainly to provide for carry through effects of the 2022-2023 public service wage increase. To note is the decrease in the total allocation in the 2023-2024 from the 2022-2023 estimate. Next slide. So in terms of the provincial, in terms of the specific conditional grants to provinces, most of the conditional grants increased in the 2023-2024 since the revised estimates in 2022-2023. The district health program grant decreases by 2,157 million. The national tertiary services grant decreases by 282 million. Education infrastructure decreases by 1,372 million. And human settlement development increases by 688 million. And provincial roads maintenance increases by 3,202 million. Next slide. Transfers to local government. So in the 2023-2024 financial year, 164 billion is allocated as direct transfers to local government, while a further 8.5 billion is allocated to be spent by national department on behalf of municipalities. Of the direct transfers, 68.3% will be transferred as an unconditional funds for municipalities to use according to the priorities determined through their council and through their budget processes. The remaining 31.7% will be transferred through conditional grants. So in the 2023-2024, government is funding free basic services to 11.2 million houses at a cost of 70.9 billion. Next slide. So in terms of the spending trends, next slide. So members, in terms of the spending trends in the national sphere of government, the first table shows the highest spending departments as at the end of December 2022. And the second table shows that has spent under 65% of their budget at the end of the third quarter. So in terms of the fastest spending departments, we have Department of Higher Education and Training, Department of Basic Education and Department of Women, Youth and People with Disabilities, which was driven by transfers and subsidies, which account for more than 80% of their allocations. And in terms of the slowest spending on national departments, the Department of Public Enterprise has spent only 38.4%, which is 12.7 billion of its budget by the end of December 2022 due to slower than planned disinvestment of funds to ESCO, as the funds are dispersed in terms of the liquidity needs of the entity, and the transport and military veterans only spent lightly. Next slide. So on a provincial level, 74.4% of income has been received and 73.2% of payments have been made. To note is that most transfers have been made, but payments for capital assets was at 62.8%. Next slide. In terms of the conditional grants transferred, and actual payments as of 31 December 2022. Disable is just showing the slow, slow spending on those conditional grants. We have the Comprehensive Agricultural Support Grant, for example, which spent 56.4%, and the National Health Insurance Grant, which spent only 51.5%, and the informal human settlement partnership grant to provinces, which only spent 59.1%. Next slide. This is just a continuation which reflects the same thing, the slowest spending grants. Next slide. So members, when assessing the efficiency and effectiveness of expenditure, one has to evaluate performance. Our assessment of the performance of basic education, health, human settlement, agriculture, and transport conditional grant in the 2020-2021 financial year showed that the information provided in the DORAS schedules is neither relevant nor adequate to determine efficiency and effectiveness of expenditure, because there is a two-year lag between current year and actual performance data that is reported in the schedules. Therefore, we had to evaluate performance information reflected in the National Department's annual report, which showed that performance outputs or indicators were not well defined. There was a duplication of indicators or outputs. There was poor or no reporting on actual non-financial information. In some instances, there were no targets for the outputs. There was overspending on some of the grants that has accompanied by underperformance, or there was underspending that has been accompanied by overperformance. So reporting on performance was not measured against set targets. So there was incomplete in performance information. So the lack of proper information on conditional grants in the annual reports of departments is difficult to determine the effectiveness of expenditure and impact on the and impact of the outputs delivered by the provincial departments. Next slide. I'll hand over to Petelo to continue from here.
Thank you, Mapula. Good morning, Chairperson and honorable members. We'll be taking you through the state of local government fiscal space. These graphs here shows that municipalities are self-financing in nature, with over 85% of their total revenue being the generated own revenues. And that comes from the service charges and the property rate. However, Chairperson, as we speak, the financial stability of municipalities has continued to deteriorate, and currently the municipalities that are in financial distress has increased to 169. This number was 66 a decade ago, and it was 86 5 years ago. So poor revenue management and inability of municipalities to effectively raise own revenue are some of the biggest causes of the financial distress of municipalities. This results into municipalities being unable to effectively deliver services to the citizens. So some of the key issues that I identify within the municipal budget is the growing grant dependence that municipalities continue to, or the government grant is increasing at a faster pace than their own generated revenues within municipalities. And the other issue is the inadequate maintenance expenditure that municipalities tend to delay maintenance of infrastructure, which pushes the cost of that expenditure in that current financial year, and risking the degradation of the infrastructure in future, which can cause even higher expenditure. The outstanding of consumer debt is also one of the issues that is highlighted as a possible issue of governance within this municipality. So, Chairperson, the point that we are making here, and my colleague has presented the situational analysis of the local government, is that the business model is not effectively working, because the basic needs provision requires more money and most households cannot afford those services. So many households, they end up having competing needs, whether to buy food or to buy services. At the end of the day, municipalities are forced to push the tariffs for services in order to raise more revenues, in order to provide those services, even though they know that households cannot really afford these services. So this further pushes households in a situation where the manifestation of protest may become a resultant of that situation. We can move into the next slide. Next slide, please. Chairperson, in light of the growing concern of underspending by national departments over the past years and the projected underspending in the current financial year by National Treasury, the office has undertaken to conduct the historical analysis of the government spending. This exercise that we did as an office, it seeks to identify those departments that are driving the underspending, the areas of underspending within those departments, and the possible reason for underspending. So if we look into this graph, the top table, it shows that the total appropriation by vote has been incurring underspending over the years, except in the financial year 2019-2020, where there was overspending. And the below table shows that the drivers of this underspending is from the current payment, which is your goods and services, and also the transfers are also contributing to the underspending. You can move into the next slide. This slide, Chairperson, summarizes the key finding of the study that we conducted as an office, and the key issues for further consideration for oversight purposes. The underspending of our government budget phenomena is not unique to South Africa, as the literature shows that other countries also struggle with spending their budget. And the literature also further shows that weaknesses in the budget planning, execution, and procedures are also a critical contributors into the underspending by government. So some of the reasons for underspending cited by the department is procurement processes. This relates to the non-compliance to SCM policies and regulation, and inadequate monitoring and evaluation of SCM have been cited by many entities as a reason for underspending. The other major reason is the delay in the payment of suppliers, invoices, or claim by department. It's also a major reason for underspending, and it is therefore worth to highlight that delays in payment of invoice is also in breach of Treasury regulation, which says these invoices must be settled or must be paid within 30 days of receipt. The other reason of delays or underspending is the delays in filling of critical posts in government departments and entities, because compensation of employees and expenditure is linked to government service delivery. Therefore, the failure to fill the critical post by the government department has a direct impact in the ability of the department or of government to deliver the much needed services to the citizens. The other reason is the interdepartmental systemic issues. This could be your inefficient processes, unnecessary tape, or the communication with the department. These issues can build up, and at the end of the day, they deprive citizens of the services that they need. So they end up increasing the inefficiencies within the departmental projects, particularly in infrastructure, which also need to be addressed. In terms of conditional grant, Chairperson, failing to comply to the conditions set out in the conditional grant, they also lead to underspending, and then the funds then may be returned, or they are returned back to the national department. Therefore, it is important to always link the conditional grant budget to a specific delivery goal. So this is the study, the first study of its kind that the office has conducted, and we're planning to continue doing the underspending analysis of other votes, which are more critically important for service delivery. I will hand over to my colleague to do the second adjustment, appropriation bill, and the summary. Thank you so much, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. You may continue.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you, Honorable Chair. Next slide. In terms of the second appropriation bill, the revision to the non-interest expenditure is as follows. The public service wage bill increases by 14.6 billion. The increase are between 3 million and 1.9 billion, depending on the size of the national department. And one for SAA, which is 1 billion to assist with the outstanding historical debt. All government guarantees to SAA will be cancelled. Proof of funds to the strategic equity partner transaction needs to be provided, and National Treasury will review the SEP agreement to prevent future fiscal obligations, and the allocation to the South African Postal Office, which is 2.4 billion equity injection. Several conditions apply, including the placement of the entity under administration, and one to the land bank, 5 billion, and 3 billion for the blended finance program, and 2 billion for the remedy of its default position. And several conditions also apply here for the land bank. Thank you very much. I'll hand over to the director to conclude.
Thank you so much, colleagues. Chair, I think what we're emphasizing here is that the country's socioeconomic challenges show that government spending on social protection is an important policy intervention, and as we've seen over the years, how much that has supported households and the economy itself. But I think what we try to emphasize that members to take into account is the fact that the level of socioeconomic deterioration over time really shows that the proposed spending over the medium term remains really inadequate to address some of these concerns. Another point also which emphasizes is around the issues of crime statistics. It really shows that we have some of concerns with some of the crimes that relate to socioeconomic issues. And I think what we're trying to emphasize that is that the spending in the portfolio has to be better aligned with the risks identified within the sector, but also better aligned, because in some areas you see that even if spending increases, the outcomes, budget outcomes deteriorate further over time. Government has made slow progress in realizing education outcomes over time, especially in line with our commitments in the MTSF, which comes to an end next year. And particularly, we are concerned about the impacts of the early child development, particularly for the more low-income households in this regard. And we are concerned that in medium-term proposals show a lack of or not sufficient regard in this area. And also, we see also that the children, which is really a result of not sufficient spending in child development, see that grade fours have not, or we have not been able to realize our outcomes in really ensuring that children at a certain age are able to read and at least are comparable with their counterparts in other countries. We've also seen that actually the education is an important determinant of employment over the years, but also in the literature does emphasize that the more you have higher educations, the better you have chances to get employed or absorbed in the employment environment. Also, there's concerns around healthcare sector, the fact that it's overstretched and remains unfunded, and we're concerned that that has to be taken into account quite more sufficiently over the medium term. And we are concerned the proposals are not doing enough, but also trying to link it back with what C. Peter just said, the underspending and what it means for really realizing the outcomes there. Local government is an important area where it has a first line of defense between the government and services, but we're concerned about the lack of services, but also the dissatisfaction in services, which leads to more unsatisfaction in society. We see that the spending on average increased by 4.5% in nominal terms over the medium term, and that's how it goes over the medium term. Over the next financial year, we know that the government's level, the grants level increases by 5%. However, the increase is inadequate given the fact that the cost of living has been so high over time, particularly post the COVID-19. We've seen the cost of living biting more so in the more everybody really, but I think more low-income households being impacted more in this regard. And I would feel that budget could provide some security in a more sufficient way. Provincial equity shares increased by 2.5% over the MTF on average. And also, most of the provincial culture grants have been revised since the last estimates. I've seen some more allocations to local government, but also even the culture grants being impacted in that regard. And the issue of underspending, Chair, we've really went out into a series of really reviewing some of the spending in these areas. We've started with health, we'll be doing education and some other functions, but I actually wanted to put this really some of the reasons, some of the consideration going forward, that should not really be used as a measure to reduce spending particular functions, because reducing spending functions does not necessarily mean the service demand requirements will be declined in particular. So it's very important consideration for us to give to the members. And we are still concerned about this regard. Chair, members and colleagues, we would like to stop here and thank you so much for the opportunity. And we are available for any questions in this regard. Thank you so much, Chair. Thank you, colleagues.
Thank you very much, Dr. Ganji and Team Treasury, Team PBO. Like I indicated that I'm experiencing load shedding, and I'm not even sure if you can hear me now, but my network is very unstable. I'll request Honorable Njatu to help me with the proceedings on deliberations, and Lebabalo and Estelle, please assist in identifying the hands. Honorable Njatu, be on the alert.
Good morning, Chairperson. Good morning to all the members. Thank you very much, Chairperson, to take further the meeting. Chairperson, just for the meeting's purpose, is just to thank first FFC and PBO on the presentations, and also the presenters on the detailed presentations they have provided. And now we will give an opportunity now to the members of the committee. I see two hands, Honorable Ryder and Honorable Ocamp, Honorable Tatuet, Honorable Molotsane. Let's give the sequence in terms of the hands. We will start with Honorable Ryder, followed by Honorable Ocamp, then followed by Honorable Molotsane, and then followed by Honorable Tatuet. Let's take that order, members. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair, very much indeed. I'm glad I'm not being suppressed like I was yesterday, put to the back of the queue. No, thanks for the presentations. I think there's a lot to cover, so I'm going to try and go through it quite quickly. So in terms of the second adjustment appropriation bill, which was handled first, I think that there's lots of things that should be concerning us about this. Now, we note the bailout to the post office, yet they are closing offices left, right, and center, which is impacting the payment of the grants and accessibility to our people who are wanting to access the post office for various reasons. Obviously, their financial issues are replicated by postal services around the world, who have seen with the advent of email and WhatsApp a big drop in terms of the volume that they're processing. And I mean, certainly if you're buying a stamp for, I don't know what it costs these days, R1.80, I think somewhere around that, if you're charging just that to send a letter, it's no longer viable. But we've seen no reinvention. We've seen no real change in the way the post office works. It's pretty much just a case of, well, you know, this is how we've always worked and we're going to carry on forward. So, you know, what are the proposals in terms of making the post office viable? And I think we spoke about the SOEs broadly in the presentations from both presenters. And yet there's no reinvention of any of the SOEs and no updating of how they operate the operating models, et cetera, et cetera. I do know that there's a bill coming to us. It'll be the post office bank bill. But that's going to bring a burden. That's going to bring a financial cost onto the country because that bank is going to have to be capitalized and so on. And I'm not sure that we're going to see much benefit from that because it was, you know, it's too late. We're 15 years too late. The commercial banks were all forced to open Mzansi accounts or to establish these Mzansi accounts and so on, because the post office bank was broken at the time. So those Mzansi accounts are now, you know, common and being used all over the place, which has meant that an introduction of a post office bank, I think, is 15 years too late and no longer going to be viable. Anyway, let's have some comments on that, please. The SIA bailout, yes, I think that million rand was largely expected, but we would like to hear some progress on the secret deal that's happening, you know, behind closed doors. No one has any details. Is there going to be much more that goes or not? And then I think the next one, of course, is the land bank, the clarity around the mandate of the land bank, I think, is something that we still require. Are they a development finance institution? Are they a proper commercial entity? And, you know, I think we've had lots of concerns with the way that they're operating as well in terms of some of their heavy-handedness and some issues around there. I think the political parties funds, I heard Kasatu's argument yesterday and I was partly convinced by some of it, but I do think it's bad timing. And I think that having an adjustments appropriation to fund political parties when people are sitting in financial hardship, I think this is a hard sell and something that residents, citizens of South Africa are not going to be happy with. The fact that we seem to be funding political parties when actually there's actually for them much greater priorities, certainly. The SRD grant underspending, I think, is bad. It's something we need to check on very carefully. We need to check, and I don't believe it's through anything other than just the tough conditions that have been put on qualifying for the grant. I'd love to be convinced otherwise, but perhaps the underspending on that could indicate that actually we need to increase that grant. So if it's not only the real desperate people that need to get that, perhaps we can increase it slightly because 150 rand is not a great amount and not going to help many others. Good. So then moving on to Division of Revenue, and I think that it's actually quite tough to fit both of these presentations, or both of these things, into one meeting. I mean, PBO and FFC already compete for time, and we know for a fact PBO is going to run over their time again this afternoon. But, you know, PBO slides, there were 59 slides that they presented to us, and they were given 15 minutes. So the planning is probably a little bit tight, but I must be honest and say that a lot of the information there is incredibly useful for us and needs to be unpacked further, Chairperson. And I think that this points to the fact that we need to digest what's been brought to us here today and open discussions with SALGA, open discussions with provincial treasuries, and discuss some of the key themes that have come out. So I do think that some of the analysis that came from PBO specifically was quite superficial in terms of explaining away reasons for things that I don't buy personally. But, you know, they're trying to put forward reasons from the analysis that they're able to get. But I don't think that we've had proper engagement yet with SALGA, deep engagement as to what are the real issues around underspending. And I mean, so the comment from PBO was that there are complex procurement processes leading to underspending. And I buy that 100%. That's far from superficial. That's a good analysis in my view. Let's hear from SALGA what their issues are on that. And I think what you'll find is that they'll turn around and say, look, the national departments give money and taketh money away, in a lordly manner, if one can say. But honestly, there's no certainty in terms of what's going to be coming. And one only has to have a look at the Citibank Regional Sewer Scheme and look at how the money is kind of dropped in and then removed, and our big regional bulk infrastructure grant that has been ring-fenced for that. The ability to spend has been taken away from municipalities. But now we see underspending in RBIG, which has resulted in a massive downturn in the regional bulk infrastructure grant. And this is a very worrying signal in the midst of what we're calling our water crisis, our sanitation crisis, when we're seeing so much sewage pollution into our drinking resources. And not only in Mfuleni and the Vaal River, but we're seeing it all over the country. You know, Mfuleni, everyone knows, is my favorite one to bring up, but it's happening all over the country, Chair. And the fact that regional bulk infrastructure grant is down, this is the stuff that builds sewage treatment plants. This is the grant that's used to build reservoirs for drinking water and so on. And the spending, there's underspending, and the projections are that it has been budgeted to go down substantially. And it's only going to catch up again in 4 or 5 years to last year's levels. Very, very concerning in the midst of the water crisis that we're warning about. Honourable Karim was at great length to say that I'm not the only one who's aware and who's talking about the water crisis. Yeah, but I mean, one has to look at government priorities. And government priorities are voiced through a budget. And if the budget's not talking to dealing with this, then it's not a government priority. And that's what I'm seeing, is that regional bulk infrastructure grant is going down. So I think that, so we note and welcome the increases that are coming through for provincial and local government. And yeah, I think that how much of the increases as a result of indirect grants is an important question and needs further analysis. And I think that some of that information has come through today, and I think will be distilled over the next couple of weeks. And again, Chair, I'm imploring that we meet with provincial treasuries and get their inputs in terms of that. PBO focused on revenue collection in municipalities and made the point that, you know, local governments are supposed to be self-funding, and they're not. And PBO says that, you know, this points to a failure of the model. I don't believe it's a failure of the model. This is where I specifically feel that there was a little bit of a superficial analysis, because I think that the reasons for the revenue collection problems that are being experienced, the reasons given are not correct. And I think that, you know, I'm leaning on my own experience in local government, and the substantial, you know, oversight that I've had throughout Gauteng and the Eastern Cape when I was on the public works portfolio as well, having a look at whether local government is actually doing the revenue collection that it's supposed to be doing. And again, I'm going to pick on Mfuleni because it's the one that I know well, and say that you know, in terms of their building regulations, they are not applying SPLUMA. If you have a look at the development and planning personnel, they are just totally inadequate. They're not applying SPLUMA, so they're not collecting bulk contributions in terms of funding the increased need for infrastructure that's being brought about by the development in the area. As a result of which, they're not collecting revenue. If you're not doing rezonings, you're also rating and taxing properties at an incorrect level, and this results in under-collection. When you are billing people, they still don't like collecting. I mean, you know, we did an analysis. There were, I think, 4 properties that owe 8 million rand to the Mfuleni local municipality, and it's not being collected because it's not politically comfortable for them to collect. So it's not an issue of, well, the model's incorrect. It's an issue of the ability to drive revenue collection is not being properly utilized, either because of technical inadequacies or because of a lack of political will. And it's these issues that need to be addressed in local government, not the model. And one only has to look that there are numerous municipalities that work exceptionally well, numerous municipalities that do collect their revenue, that are experiencing 90 to 95% collection rates. You know, let's get those people in, Chairperson, and hear what their successes are. Why are they able to do this when other municipalities are sitting with 30 and 40% collection rates? In addition to which, I see very little in the analysis as well with regard to wastage. And I think that when one considers the non-revenue water and non-revenue electricity, that money being wasted, we see big debts to Eskom and to the rain and to the water boards. But a lot of it is for water that's not being billed out. So, you know, paying away money that's ending up running down the streets into the into the stormwater system because there's leaks that are not being repaired, et cetera, et cetera. And again, it's protecting the revenue coming in, but also protecting the payments that are going out. And just the inefficiencies in local government that need to be addressed. You know, the fact that people feel that, they'd much rather pay for DSTV than for their rates and taxes at the end of the month. This is something that we need to seriously challenge. I mean, I know that there was in the bad old apartheid days, there was a strategy of non-payment that was led by the African National Congress. Now the African National Congress is having trouble turning that around, that culture that they instilled, turning that around and starting to get people to contribute. But people understand, they pay for DSTV. Why aren't they paying for water? Why aren't they paying for electricity? Chairperson, I do appreciate the presentations. I am going to circulate them widely, but I do think that we need substantially more time to unpack these things. And I believe that, you know, if we're going to do a fair job to the information that's been put together for us today, we're going to need to analyze this over time. And as much as it's here to influence the current DORA, I think that we need to use some of these facts to interrogate further so that we can influence future DORAs as well, because I do believe that, something needs to change. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Ryder. Honorable Oukamp.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, yeah, I want to agree with Honorable Ryder. Yeah, covered me in a lot of these instances, but I think that we have got a very small amount of time to digest all this information. But let's go and see what we can get interacted with to these two committees. Chairperson, I want to start with bringing it back home to the Northern Cape where I come from, and specifically with regards to disasters that occurred. It is clear that we do not have a full disaster plan. Disasters like fires, especially in the Northern Cape, as happened at the end of last year and the beginning of this year, fires break out. There's no plan in place. We, from our side, collected money to get aircraft in the air because whilst government for an hour or two or a day or two are trying to figure out how they're going to curb these disasters, these fires are literally raging and carrying on. So from the public sector side, we got money and we got airplanes in the air. And in certain instances, we got help from the local governments afterwards or the provincial government afterwards, but it's too little too late. Can the FFC and PBO advise this committee as how to best government can streamline the processes of disaster response to ensure swift action is taken when disasters occur without disadvantaging other spheres of government? With regards to the SRD grant and the stringent criteria thereon, how best can this criteria be adjusted without impacting negatively on the most needy people, and while at the same time addressing the issues of corruption that has taken place in the social grant space? We know that there are people that got social grants, but they are earning money at other places, that they got more than one bank account, etc. Certain amounts of these adjustments was done to prevent leakages like that, but it seems that it is not effective. What can we do in that regard? Another question to both FFC and PBO is, what will be the best way to address the challenges facing the fiscally unsound state-owned enterprises without breaking the fiscus? We see each time how these state-owned enterprises are mismanaged. They are due to various reasons, corruption, cadre deployment, BEE policies that are not applied correctly. These state-owned enterprises are run into the ground. We are continuously putting money into them, but there aren't any real plans to turn that around. Can the FFC and PBO both reply on that, please? I've been covered on the post office. The other question what I want to ask is, the committee also agrees that capacity building measures should be comprehensive and there should be proper consultation with municipalities concerned to ensure that the correct diagnosis comes out. But it seems that this is not taking place. What can be done to assist in that matter? According to the PBO, the increase in poverty, inequality, poor quality of services, unevenness is attributed to the inadequate social wage. But, Chairperson, there are other factors that also come into play when it comes to these financial leakages, and that is unemployment, the way in which unqualified and inexperienced people are appointed due to cater deployment or nepotism, and that leads to mismanagement of the very social wages that we are talking about. Should we always throw money into the problem? What is your view on this, and how can this be curbed? I have been covered with regards to people that have got money to pay for certain services, like, for instance, DSTV, or maybe have a car that they can pay off, but they can't pay for their services. We see that municipalities are battling because of the non-collection of revenue for services that they deliver. I think we've got, in some instances, a culture of non-payment in South Africa, and that needs to be addressed. We cannot have it that people who can pay and can afford to pay for their services does not do that. And the people that are really battling, that really does not have the means to do so, can't get help and proper assistance from government, because people that can do goes through the cracks of the system, does not pay, and in the other hand, on the other hand, get grants because they are really fooling around with the system. Thank you, Jefferson. I'll leave it at that. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Honorable Okam. Just before I give to the next three speakers, which is Honorable Molotsane, Honorable Detweit, Honorable Yunus Karim, just before I give to you, I just understand now that on my side, you load shedding will be at 12, but I have connected to the router. So I don't think I will be cutting off, just for in case, Honorable Karim, if there's any problem, but I don't think I will be cut out. So let's go on, move on.
Comrade Chair. Comrade Chair, Eunice.
Yes.
You might have been late, but I attended an apology because I have to attend another parliamentary meeting at 12 o'clock. because this comes from the speakers and I think the chair's office, I have to attend it. I don't even know fully what's about, but I'm meant to be there. I think I know. So I've got to leave at about 3 minutes to 12 to connect with that meeting. So I won't be at 12, but Comrade Mamarakhane is here and others who can chair. Sorry about that. It's a parliamentary meeting of some chairs or something, I think. Okay. Sorry about that.
I accepted, Honorable Karim. But I don't think I will be cut off where my router is on. Honorable Morosane, followed by Honorable Detweit, and then Honorable Karim.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me start first by acknowledging the two presentations. Some of my questions have been covered by the previous speakers. The only question that I would like to pose to the PBO is that given the fact that there is an above inflation increase, is the allocation of local government to cater for the high standard of living in the households who qualify for the basic services? Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Honorable Molotsane, Honorable Detweit.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I'm going to leave my camera off with load shedding on this side. Firstly, thank you for the presentations. It's appreciated. I want to find out if the presenters can maybe allude to the fact that it's common knowledge that the social gap is expanding. And we are currently experiencing a population explosion in the country. But what's not happening is the broader public is not educated enough, according to me, with regards to this and the implications
that this population explosion has in the country. We've got growing unemployment, growing poverty. I mean, stunting is taking place still. And that is something that's not addressed. Don't you, the presenters, feel that that is something that needs a lot of attention? Then I'm going to jump to SAA, the bailouts. I mean, it's evident we've lost millions of rands that it was poured into this black hole of SAA. And I want to know, have we been, or have you maybe seen the financials of SAA? Is there any progress in their current financial status, in their financial position? Obviously, the government still has some shares in SAA. And do you anticipate that we would have to bail SAA out again in the coming 2 years or so? I'm not referring to the historical challenges, but I'm referring to the current business model, and are they actually showing the profits that one would like to see? And then with regards to the other SOEs that we never talk about, that are definitely, their books are not up to scratch. I mean, only the Development Bank of South Africa was able to provide a clear set of books. Do you anticipate that some of the other 700 SOEs might be knocking on government's door for bailouts in the next year or two? And if yes, about how many? Thank you, Chair. That's all from me at this stage.
Thank you very much, Honorable Letweit. The last speaker will be Honorable Karim. Just the hands, you can take down the hands. Honorable Karim.
Yeah, okay, thank you. I don't have much to say. Firstly, a question about SAA. I think others have already put questions, which I think need to be answered. But I'm not sure how this amount allocated is sufficient for SAA, whether it's sufficient and what will it mean. It does seem small compared to what I read in the media is required. And obviously it's complicated by a lack of understanding on our part. The Public Enterprises Committee will know more about what it is in respect of this deal that is complicating the situation, and also it seems like the money that's meant to come from the side of the purchaser hasn't come, and then it gets confused. You don't know what's going on. So I think there needs to be greater clarity on that, certainly. Secondly, yeah, I agree with Dennis. I think we all agree there's a water crisis, and I think we all agree that more money should be given, and something we should say in our report. But obviously we have to balance that against other basic needs, but clearly water is a preeminent priority. In respect of the local government model, I agree. I was there. I chaired the committee from 1998, just after the white paper was finished. Now, to be fair to the experts, they did a lot of work. A lot of them were university experts and international experts that looked at the formula for the equitable share. Sorry, let me just go. And the local government model and finances. But I do think we were wrong collectively as politicians to take to that and as experts. But many of the things couldn't have been foreseen. So I don't think it's completely the failure of the model. It's also the failure of the politicians and the CFOs and the MMs and the senior officials to manage whatever money they have in a way that's delivering services in a productive way. Instead, we've got mismanagement, corruption, lack of direction, lack of skills, and the stuff we've been talking about for years now, but not making much progress on. You know, I agree with the suggestion that we should discuss these documents more. But even more, colleagues, I feel that, I have to exit because this is the co-chair wanting me in there. So it's fine, I've got nothing new to say, except we need more action. Can you please excuse me? This is a parliamentary meeting I'm supposed to be at, and I think there's some discussion we have to have before that.
Thank you, Honorable Karim. Let me quickly just have one also from my side. My question will be, according to FFC and PBO, what will be the best way to address the challenges facing fiscally unsound SOEs without breaking the fiscus? That is my one question. And then the second one is, according to PBO, the non-payment of services is due to poverty and not on the unwillingness to pay by households. And that might be true to some extent. But what is your view about households who can afford to pay for DSTV, which is entertainment, but unable to pay for the basic services such as electricity, hence the illegal connections? That is the two questions, will be the two questions from my side. And then without delaying, I will then give over to PBO and FFC. Honorable Ryder?
Sorry, Chair. Just noting that I had left something expecting either one of the two chairs to pick it up. If I can just have a second bite, if I can do that. I note that with them not commenting, we've a little bit ahead of timing schedule.
Continue, Honorable Ryder.
Thank you very much, Chair. I do note that in terms of the substantial move to solar energy that is being encouraged, this is going to have an impact on certainly local government's revenue collection, because there is a margin that local government makes on electricity, generally speaking. So while that margin is under pressure, I think that the solar, the move to solar and the encouragement of a lot of people that are generally people that pay their rates and taxes and pay their service consumption, I think that the switch of these people to kind of off the grid systems is going to have a substantial impact on local government's funding. And I'd love to hear PBO and FFC's comment on that. Coupled to that, but quite separate, is the fact that with the increases, the annual increases that NERSA permits Eskom to put through, it's noted that the margin is under pressure because NERSA gives local government a slightly lower amount that they are permitted to pass on to their consumers. So what we are seeing is that, for example, and I'm going to use round figures, NERSA grants Eskom a 10% increase, but municipalities are only allowed to pass on a 9.5% increase to their consumers. Now, the margin that has traditionally been charged is used for a number of things. Number one, it's used to fund the maintenance of the electrical network and ensure that normal reticulation maintenance can be done. Number two, it's there to ensure that there can be expansion in terms of the electrical network that's provided, the reticulation side of things that happens in municipal jurisdictions where they have licenses to provide that reticulation. And number three, there's a case of a very small amount of cross-subsidization where that margin is used to fund other services that are not self-funding or not billable. So this is under tremendous pressure, and that margin squeeze has been happening for quite some time. Is there any analysis that's been done on that margin squeeze by FFC or PBO, and can they give us an impression of how that's impacting local government in terms of their service delivery? Thank you very much. Noting that it's just gone over to 12 o'clock, and without assuming the role of the chair, I think that the chair had already indicated the next step would be for FFC and then PBO to respond.
Thank you, honorable members, for the questions. Also load shedding, having a challenge here, but I'll try to see if my camera can sustained. Thank you so much, honorable members, for all the questions and the deliberations on this matter. I just want to comment on two issues on my side, and then I'll ask the research team as well as the commissioners who are on the platform to make their own comments. With regards to the state-owned entities, Honorable Ryder and others, we know that the national debt and SOEs remain glaring constraints to growth and a risk to fiscal sustainability. Debt service cost is the fastest growing expenditure line item, and each successive bailout worsens the problem. So the detrimental effect of debt service cost crowding out social programs could actually lead to a total collapse of basic services and service delivery. And this is a reality that we need to face as a possibility, because funds which are intended for core spending will be diverted to service the debt. So SOEs in this regard then pose a huge risk. I think we have been quite clear as FFC in this regard. And then with regards to the municipalities, a lot of the honorable members have expressed their views, which we welcome, and we are also in alignment with those views. My view is that those who are implementing the budget that Parliament and this forum implements should actually shoulder greater responsibility to ensure that these allocations find expression in better and quality service delivery on the ground, that the service delivery architecture on the ground actually is improved because of these allocations. So it's no use for us as FFC, as PBO, and as Parliament making budget allocations to municipalities that are dysfunctional and to national departments that cannot disperse relief funds that are earmarked for the poorest of the poor. So it just means that the problem is not about the money. The problem is about state capacity to deliver. So this is actually a more daunting problem, because it cannot just be resolved through the budgeting process itself. It needs to be addressed in a far more more deeper way. So the budgeting process in this instance, yes, does achieve its aims, but on the ground, do those services reach the people that are supposed to benefit from them? I think that is the key issue. And whether there is state capacity at local and provincial government, even at national government, to actually disperse these funds effectively. I would like to find out if Commissioner Mokadi is on the platform. He might have a comment. Then after him, I would like to hand over to the head of research. Does look like Commissioner Mokadi is not on the platform. Therefore, I'd like to hand over to our head of research, Mr. Chen Sang.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Uncle Chair members. What to do about these fiscally unsustainable, infeasible SOEs? Honorable Chair members, I think if there were other ways, and we've certainly tried other ways, all means available from a financial point of view, monetary point of view, we would have tried them by now. And that it seems to me that it ultimately comes down to failure. And that means that the only means available or the option for us now is, as I say, it's to reinvent, and reinvent is also therefore a need for termination and restructuring. It's going to be painful, but I think it would be more painful If we keep trying the same thing that we know and have at the empirical evidence of thereof to know that it hasn't worked. And indeed, as Honorable Rider say, some of these are also, again, through tested means and many years of trials. It's the issue of obsolete business models and of these SOEs and functions to some extent. Specifically on some of the, and that's why we keep emphasizing on the sectoral nature, the specificity of these SOEs in terms of their functions and what is the goods, public goods and services that it's delivering and the roles and functions that it plays for the larger economy. And the world and economy has moved and evolved. And these business models, and I mean operational models, not even to the point of financial and so forth, because financial, it's more of an outcome. It's a sign, a signal of the operations. I think at this point, the only way forward is about restructuring. This goes in line with what the Honorable Ockham and others have asked about the best ways to address SOEs. In terms of the, I want to get to the point about this culture of non-payment, because this one is quite tricky in a sense and quite nuanced. It's not all just somebody or households, not wanting to pay, because, we all try to save some money, but it's also one from a public sector perspective and government perspective. It's important to know the chain, the value chain of this. So just to remind Honorable Chairman ourselves about the chain is there's generation for bulk purchases of the basic goods or services of electricity, for example, by municipalities. Then municipalities reticulate these bulk services into services, basic services for households. So if there is no generation, then there is nothing to reticulate. There's nothing to purchase and there's no margin to be had by municipalities. And of course, without services, there's nothing to collect with. So there is issues. I think, we can say that there are household individual behaviors, sort of the microeconomic behaviors of buying DSTV as opposed to buying, say, water or electricity. But a bigger question, I think, and to be fair on the households and people of South Africa, and where we, us as governments need to consider and of course Parliament is oversight of the governments, is that did the public sector ensure that there are these services accessible to the public as per the words in the Constitution? So I just want to highlight that before it runs into a simply culture of non-payments. Sure, there are, there are certain instances of malice and abuse of systems in terms of this culture of non-payments. But one has to also realize that whilst that is a possibility, and we certainly will have to establish, and there are established enforcement and mechanisms to it, but we have to also make sure that we are providing as governments, as public sector, what we should and must in terms of the Constitution. A social wage is definitely widening in terms of the increasing disparity, because as my chairperson correctly said, some of it and most of it actually is being diverted And more also with that, it's also eroded by implementation failures. And SOE is one of those arms that has been being the funds and the resources that's supposed to have gone into social wage and facing the danger of being diverted into that. And therefore, exposures, Honorable Chairman, how much? So according to, it's not in this particular slide, but we did present as FFC on the, in terms of the government guarantee exposures. So exposures is the actual money or guarantees being utilized by the, by entities because they have faced, shall we say, a shortage of cash. And that's why they call a exposure. And that is about close to about 400 billion for that. Of course, the biggest chunk would go to Eskom for 337.8 billion. And so that where we think about exposure, it's more than likely, and especially given the historical trend of it, it's more than likely that that trend will continue. The next big one would be, for example, SANRAL, who has exposed about 28 billion, and then it's Transnet, about 8.7 billion. The list goes on, and that is, if you look at the past 3 years, those have been the similar fluctuation, you know, roughly the figures. And so that, therefore, going forward in terms of the median term, that is the exposure and also entities that will be coming knocking on our door for money. I think that is overall, of course, I want to end off with the last response regarding what does it mean really at the macro level for these bailouts and a persistent failure of the SOEs. I think for this committee and also all oversight bodies is if may the committee consider the long-term, the forward consequences of these SOEs continue to fail, because then the spotlight is going to start shining on the issue of oversights on Parliament. And I think without us laboring this issue, it has started to sort of start shifting the focus. Yes, these are supposed to have been executed by the executive authority, meaning the executive branch of government, departments, ministers, cabinets. But if that has not worked, then accountability demands that the next line, the oversight body, must be or be held to question. Thank you, Chair. That's our submission and response and to this submission. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. I am back. Who are sharing?
Oh, okay. It's okay. Fine. Can we take thanks, Honorable Njatu will be assisting each other. I'm not even confident with my connectivity. Over to PBO.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. My director sends his apologies. He had to go off to another meeting, so I'll try and manage the PBO response and we'll be asking my colleagues to come in soon. I just want to thank the members, honorable members, for the questions and their comments. And I think those have been really valuable. And I agree that a lot of these issues, both from FFC and from PBO, need to be unpacked and discussed more. And, you know, as the PBO, when we're given certain we raise certain questions and we're given certain time to present. There may be times when our discussions come across as superficial. and I think that's just the nature of these hearings. We're all under pressure. We're all try to say things and make it say things succinctly and in an understandable way, but sometimes the time pressures affect us. And so I think if we are given more space, I think we can give more detail. And I think, for instance, on the understipending project, I think the members should realize that we are at the beginning of working on this. We've looked at three departments so far. Our approach has been, we've developed a specific methodology. Our approach initially has been to understand the trends and to unpack the data and to do analysis of the data. And then we've done a literature review looking at the global situation, what lessons we can learn from other countries. And then we've also looked at the literature on South Africa. But I think what Honorable Ryder was saying is that we need to speak to SALGA and we need to speak to people within government and government entities and local governments themselves before we actually have a deeper understanding of these issues. And so what we are presenting here is sort of a first round of findings that we actually think are compelling enough to present at this point. And the one important finding for us is that if you just look at the national level at the data and spending by departments, then for many of them over many years, they're not actually underspending by more than 2%. There are specific reasons. And we're also finding that, you know, maybe one of the reasons for this, for instance, with the Department of Health is that there's such a need and there's such a backlog that, you know, even if they aren't performing efficiently, even if, you know, in a perfect world, they would be underspending, because of the pressures on them, they actually are not underspending given the resources they have. And if we keep giving them more resources, they'd actually, I think, be able to spend them as well. So I think we're learning from this process and we're sort of coming up with findings from an analysis. And I think it's really important in the future of this project, which could happen, you know, over the next year or so, that we actually then test some of our analysis, our empirical conclusions with the actual players and do case studies, whether it's with successful municipalities, like successful municipalities, other government departments. When it comes to the issue of, you know, the business model of local governments, again, our analysis is at a very broad level. And I think looking at this as a national problem and whether the business model of the level of self-financing actually helps, we're not denying that there are lots of people who don't pay. We're not denying that there's lots of efficiency. We're also not denying that there's lots of wastage and corruption. And to some extent, we one of the things we want to argue is that we need to look at how these things impact on each other. You know, the direction of causation between inefficiency and wastage and then not getting enough money is a two-way street. And often we just say, well, we shouldn't be giving more money to inefficient government departments or local government municipalities, etc., because they're just going to waste the money. But part of the problems and inefficiency may have arisen because of long-term underfunding, and that's part of what we're saying. The other thing we're saying is that, and I think my colleague from the FSC made this point, that we can't just talk about people choosing not to pay. And there may be people who are, and there are people who are choosing to pay for satellite TV subscriptions rather than pay their water bills. But a large number of people are actually having to make difficult choices between feeding their families, their children, and paying their bills. And the issue of accessibility is not only about having electricity lines or water or taps and water and sewage to your house or your place of abode. It's also about being able to pay for that. And we spoke about how expensive and the increases in tariffs. And the increases in tariffs are directly linked to the need to raise so much money through self-funding. And so I think we need to be able to unpack that more. And I think that does require a lot more research. I don't know if PBO is able to do that level of depth of research on the issue because of our size, but also because of our broader mandate. But I think those are issues and discussions we'd like to actually take further and be part of with, and I think very much with our FSC colleagues as well, because of their greater, I think, experience and research that they've done over a long time in these areas. I'm going to call on my other colleagues now, but just to also say that on things like how do we make the disaster response, you know, fast and more reactive. That is not an area that we've actually researched and studied, and I would really I wonder whether the PBO is the correct institution to be able to provide that kind of analysis and advice, and maybe that should be coming out of another committee and researchers in another committee, but I, maybe my colleagues understand that a bit more and may want to come in. So I'm going to ask Ms. Sibieko to come in first. She did the situational context slides, and then I'll call on the others after if they have any responses. Thank you.
Thank you, Siraj. I think you've covered most of the answers. I just wanted to respond to a few. In terms of the social relief of distress grant, I think it's important to note that the grant currently receives, or SASA receives, 13 million applicants. And of course, out of 13 million, at a maximum, we're seeing about 7.8 million people being approved for the grants themselves. And so I think it's important to kind of step back and acknowledge that there are a lot of people who really need this money, and that the minimum threshold in terms of how much money you can have in account is meaning that many people are excluded. But we need to also look at, you know, if people have 350 Rand in their account, you know, an additional 350 Rand really makes a huge difference. It actually brings them to about the food poverty line. So, you know, these exclusion or means testing usually means that there are also exclusion errors, which SASA and DSD have acknowledged in the past. And I also wanted to emphasize that, you know, I think part of the broader problem about this question of how do we streamline grants and so forth requires us to do deeper analysis and understanding of intra and inter-household transfers. You know, historically, we know that households, particularly African households, are porous because of the migration type of structure that we have in terms of work. Where do people work? Where do they live? And so when we think about household income, we have to have a better nuanced idea so that we don't exclude people who are, for example, receiving money on behalf of somebody else. The money is not theirs. And this extends to other issues such as who pays for the DSTV in a household. You might, you know, so we kind of have to expand our understanding to better deal or to better adequately provide for these people or the majority of South Africans. We have to think more deeply about what do the inter and intra-household transfers look like. And in terms of understanding, I just wanted to add to what Siraj has already said, to say that in terms of our method, we really only looked at national and provincial. And so we don't have a direct response in terms of the local government sphere. But Treasury did conduct a diagnostic review in February 2022, which looked at the system of capacity building for local government. What we're reporting on in our underspending work is what departments have reported are the drivers of underspend in their annual reports. So it's not us saying this is what the underspending drivers are, but it is us collating across many years and across departments what they are actually reporting are the reasons. And so, of course, there might be even more reasons if we're to engage with those people. And as Siraj has noted, there's scope in that project to engage. In terms of the national disaster or disaster work, you know, the PBO in the past has also, we've indicated that government really needs to take more of a proactive approach rather than a reactive approach. So, you know, we've mentioned that the frequency of national disasters
is increasing. And so the question is, how do we ensure that households are resilient to the crises before they emerge? It's one thing to respond after it's happened, but it's another to really proactively build the infrastructure and the capacity to deal with that. And so this really goes to the question of redress, right? So there's been many disasters that have happened, and the AGSA has noted that a lot of these disasters that have happened in the past have not actually been audited. And so what that means is that there's a backlog that we actually don't know the size of because these issues haven't been dealt with in the past. And so part of the proactive approach really has to take into account the backlog that already exists and then to build further onto that. And just to, in terms of, there was a question around whether the above increases at local government, you know, deal with sort of the needs. And to say that, you know, it's, again, it's a question of redress. You know, if we increase expenditure now after a long time of not adequately investing at the local government level, it means that the slight increase, it's really slight, is not significant enough to really deal with the backlog again of redress that we see at the local government level. And then there was a last question about population. I think this is why it's important that we do analysis on real per capita analysis, right, to understand what are we spending per person in real terms over time, which is the PBO analysis that has been provided here. And just to let members know, you know, South Africa's actually had a decline in fertility rates over time. And so, you know, our population growth in 2016-17 was about 1.6%, but we're now at about 1.06%. So COVID has had its impact. Population growth itself has also declined. The total fertility rate has declined. And so, you know, the pressure of population isn't as large as we might believe. But it is true that, of course, the population in terms of the number of people in poverty, the number of people in unemployment, the number of people in who are destitute, those numbers of people are certainly increasing. And that's where we really have to look at. I'll leave it.
Thank you. Dr. Sekitani, do you want to come in, please?
No, Suraj, I think you answered everything. Nothing
to... Okay, thank you. Sipatello, Mr. Simlani, would you like to come in?
Dr. Suraj, I think you also covered quite a lot of ground in the slide that I presented. But one thing maybe I can note is that the answer respect read by the Honorable Driver, we take it positively that this project was meant also to stimulate the discussions around the underspending. So I think this is what we need to continue involve or engage the stakeholders that are at play or that are involved in the underspending project. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. And finally, Chepo, do you have anything to add?
I think I'm covered on my side. Thank you very much, Suraj. I think you made the point. I wanted to come in on the question that was raised about what are the drivers in terms of the inability to pay for services and poverty. And to make the point that I think in the presentation, we were mainly specifically referring to indigenous households who do not have the resources to pay. And as Lucy outlined in her presentation, the mere fact that a number of these households, indigenous households, have not been able to access these free basic services because of the inefficiencies in terms of the systems that allow us to identify these particular households. And to say that it's also linked to the issue around the inadequacy in terms of data, with issues around the general household survey as well, that's as they indicated in terms from a lack of funding point of view, that if we don't have these statistics, it means that from a policy implementation and in terms of identifying these households, we'll always have gaps there. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. If I have a minute left, Chair, with your permission, I'd just like to say something about the SOEs. And I think a very good point was made by honourable members and by the FFC about the need for new business models and looking at how things have changed and the need to update that. And I think, you know, when it comes to Eskom, we all know it's working on a 150-year-old utility model, and that there's a move towards a much more modular approach, and the you know, the prices of renewables have come down, and in South Africa, and even our neighbors to the north of us, you know, are some of the richest spaces in the world for solar and wind. And I think in the future, we're going to be being looked more and more towards our ability to actually harvest those renewable resources. And so I think we would have to take, I think, a bigger picture view on the power utilities, but also I think in terms of water, the recirculation and storage of water, the fact that there hasn't been adequate maintenance of pipes and storage facilities, etc., and the importance of that. I think I agree with both what Mr. Ryder and Mr. Curry was saying, and I think in the future PBO will be carrying out more research beyond just I think we've done a lot on ESCOM, but we need to actually look into all the others and you know, the contingent liabilities, the needs for funding, the question of whether what the PFMA says about SOEs and them having to be profitable and to be able to invest based on their balance sheets, whether within the current framework and given the polycrisis we're facing as a world, whether those are the that is still realistic. So we can't, I think, get into that in much more detail, and we've taken up a lot of your time. So honorable members, honorable chair, thank you very much for giving us this space.
Thank you very much, Team PVO and Team FSC. Very progressive according to Honorable Ryder and the members. And also coming from the side of myself, the chairperson, I'm very impressed with the responses that we have received. I think they will help us. They will take us somewhere. We are, you know, raising these questions because each time we engage, things are said since the presentations, and also consultation with the public. There are things that are being intrigued, and when you come to engage with us, we come to this platform, you really become useful and resourceful to us. We get empowered. We want to take this opportunity on behalf of the committee to really appreciate the engagement. I think they will take us forward and enrich our report, our conclusions, our recommendations to the House to make sure that we resolve on these matters to better the lives of the citizens of South Africa. I would like to take this opportunity to allow PBO and FFC to step off the platform, and thank you very much, as we are now going to deal with in-house matters. Thank you very much, colleagues.
Thank you
and
so much.
Well, take care.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you. Goodbye.
Chairperson FFC, I'm still waiting. Okay, the minutes, can you see the minutes? The minutes
are... I'm with you, Chairperson. I'm uploading them now. I just want to pin my documents. I opened a lot of documents, so I just want to close them.
Okay.
So that I can... access the minutes.
February 23rd, we start with those ones.
Correct, Chairperson.
Okay, thank you. Honorable members, I know you have received the minutes and we'll go as usual. If there's anything that you have not communicated to the secretariat after going through the minutes, you can stop us. We're on page one, attendees. On page two, continuation of attendees. Page three. And page four. That's where the discussion started. Page five. Page six, honorable members. Page seven. Page eight. Resolutions and conclusions on page nine. End of the meeting. Honorable members, can I hear from you if these minutes reflect the true, is represented the true reflection of the discussions on the day, the 23rd of February 2023? Can I get a mover for the adoption, please? Am I audible?
Rider moves, Chair.
Was that, is that Honorable Rider?
That's correct, Chairperson.
That's right.
Thank you. Can I get a seconder? Can I get a seconder, Honorable Members? Honorable Rider moved.
I got Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Njadu. The next set of the minutes, 28 Feb 2023.
There are two sets of minutes for the 28th, Chairperson. We'll start with the follow-up engagement with the minister. And the last set, which is the second set for the 28th, is the briefing by PO.
Okay, apart from the one of the eight. Okay, let's move page one, page two, page three, page four. Page five, page six, page seven, page eight, and page nine. Can I get a mover for the adoption of the minutes?
Thank you, Chair. I move. Mama Rahani.
Thank you, Honorable Mama Rahani, moving. Second up, please. Ntate Moletsane, uile kae? Can I get a seconder?
Second, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Njadu, seconded. The next set of the minutes on the same date. Thank you. This is a joint meeting with Standing Committee on Appropriation and Select and Standing Committee on Finance. That's page one, 14 hours meeting. Okay. page 2. Page 3, page 4, page 5, page 6, page 7, and page 8. This is the end. Can I get a mover of the adoption of the minutes, the second set of the 8th, of the 28th? Can I get a mover, Honorable?
I move, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honorable Mamaragane, moving. A seconder? Where is the pilot?
I'll second, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honorable Ocamp.
Chairperson. And honored members,
on my
draft agenda, I made mistake. I forgot to.
Which one? The 8th of March.
That's correct, Chairperson. Apologies for the inconvenience, Chair.
It is there, the 8th of March. I've seen it there. The the one that you have emailed, it's there.
Oh, okay. Thank you, Chairperson. I only mentioned the 3 when you asked about them earlier on.
Okay. Okay. Can we move from that page? That is page 1. Page 2. Page 3. Page 4, page 5, let's go, page 6, let's go, page 7, let's go, and page 8. Members will stop me if there's anything. Page 9. Page 10. Page 11. And the end of the meeting, the last part there. Can I get a mover for the adoption of the minutes?
I move, Chair.
Thank you. Is that Honorable Detoit?
That's correct, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Detoit. Can I get a seconder?
I second, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honorable Mamaragane. All minutes now have been adopted, and we are now on item number 6, which is the last item of the day. I will take this opportunity, Honorable Members. Am I audible?
Yes, you are.
Okay. Thank you very much, Honorable Members and the colleagues. I want to really appreciate your commitment, your cooperation making this the work of this committee possible, and also, you know, trying to be on the same pace with the program. We understand that we, more especially us in CE, we have very congested program. We have to be in different committees, different responsibilities that were being given, but you always make it a point that you don't miss that opportunity or that responsibility of making sure that you take the mandate of being responsible for the peace of the country. This is a huge responsibility, and I want to really pass my gratitude to you and say that don't get tired. It's going to be a very short and hectic year for us going forward. Thank you very much, honorable members. I will close the meeting at that note. Thank you. Bye.
Bye. Yeah,
thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye. Thank you.
Bye. Bye.
Bye. Thank you. Raleboha Ryder. And